Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Alicia Garcia Herrero, senior fellow at Bruegel.
And today we are discussing about the dynamic role of the private sector in the China economies and how does it place within the frame of the US and the Chinese models within the global economic system. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes as well our monthly newsletter, Zhonghua Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. Little promotion aside, I'm very happy that Weizhen Shan has joined us from Hong Kong to discuss today's topic. Weizhen Shan is chairman and CEO of PAG, a leading Asia-focused private equity firm and the author of Money Games, the inside story of how American dealmakers saved Korea's most iconic bank. Previously, Shan was a managing director of JP Morgan and an assistant professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, where he founded the China Economic Review. This just to name just a few of the incredible experiences of Weizhen Shan, which you might want to read further in his memoir, Out of the Gobi, My Story of China and America. Thanks so much for joining us at The Sound of Economics, Shan.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Since 2010, the landscape of China's largest companies has shifted from state-owned enterprise dominance towards a more diverse and complex landscape of state-owned enterprises, mixed ownership enterprises, and non-public enterprises. However, this evolution has not really been a linear one, and for a few years we've been seeing several challenges faced by the Chinese private companies. Shan, you have a very insider look about this landscape. Could you help us to navigate and to understand, especially for our listeners, which have been the evolution in the past decade or so of the Chinese private sector?
Thank you for that question. I wouldn't be so ambitious to provide a macro view of how the private sector has progressed in the past 10 years, but I can provide my perspective. Of course, by way of a background, we are a private equity firm. My firm is called PAG. We manage about $40 billion in capital. We invest throughout Asia, but China is a major market. So we are very active in China market. And by and large, we invest in the private sector, which now contributes to about two-thirds of China's GDP. So the private sector is really the driver of China's economic growth. And as you have just mentioned, that in the past 10 years, some of the private companies have become very sizable. Many of them have become even household names globally, such as Tencent, Alibaba, TikTok, or its parent company, ByteDance, and so forth. So the private sector is very active. And I would say that what really has made a difference in the past 10 years is that the market has become much more mature. Maybe a good way to describe it is to give an example. We invested in a company just about 6-7 years ago called China Music Corporation, CMC at that time. It was a tiny company without revenue, without even much of a team. But they had one asset, and that is they have accumulated copyrights for music, which included record labels, lyrics, and music stores, which cover about 70% of the digital music market in China. And we thought that it was a very interesting company at a time when intellectual property rights were becoming very strongly enforced. And therefore, we thought the copyrights that they had would be a very strong entry barrier for the competition. And therefore, we invested in that company about 6-7 years ago. Altogether, we put in more than $100 million over time. And this year, we finally fully exited from that investment. And when we invested in the company was valued at $200 million. And we invested $100 million. Actually, initially, we invested $60 million to own 50% of the company. Later, we put more capital into the company. And still later, we merged the company with QQ Music, owned by Tencent in China. And we branded the company as Tencent Music Entertainment. And by the time we sold our stake in the company was $45 billion, you know, up from less than $200 million to $45 billion in about less than 5 years. What happened was that this company today has 800 million unique monthly subscribers. So only in China, you can get that kind of scale. Subscribing to music, paying for music. So the lesson from that particular example is that if a business model is successful, you can replicate it throughout the country. And China is a very big market. I think that's the advantage for China as well as for the United States, which is also a very big single market. So you can replicate a successful business model very quickly throughout the country to become a very scalable business. I think that's the story for China. And if you look at all these companies which have been successful in China, whether it's Alibaba, Tencent, or ByteDance, the companies that I mentioned, they have been, Meituan is another example, they have been really able to scale themselves up to become major companies in the country. That has just happened, I would say, as you pointed out, in the past 10 years.
You mentioned the United States as well. How the global, you know, landscape of how to make business in the global level and how the role of the United States has changed during this challenging landscape. What would be your take on that, especially when it comes to the effect on Chinese companies?
Well, as I mentioned, America is a very big market. And I think for e-commerce, for example, it is possible to scale up only if you operate in a very large single market. And that's why you see large companies like Amazon, like Google, like iPhone in the United States, because it's a very large single market. And you see large companies in China, whereas in Europe, which is much more fragmented, it's hard to have a very large company because, well, it is a single market, but at a different level in terms of culture, language, and so forth. Of course, there are many different markets. For example, I mentioned TME, which is very successful in China. But if you take the same model to, say, Singapore, then you wouldn't get anywhere because the market itself is not big enough. Now, there are certain companies in China which are affected by American policies, especially in the past 4 years, not 10 years, in the past 4 years, since the Trump administration. As you're aware, since 2018, there has been a trade war which has not really ceased fire, which is still going on. The tariffs do exist. And there's technology war as well. Of course, America imposed sanctions on Huawei and some other Chinese companies. So some companies are obviously affected by American policies in the past, especially 2 to 3 years, since the Trump administration. However, if you look at the effect of the trade war, which I discussed in a number of articles, including the articles I published in Foreign Affairs at the end of 2019 and early 2020, and in the Wall Street Journal, in the New York Times, I published a number of articles analyzing the effect of the trade war. It has not achieved the stated purpose of the United States, which is to reduce the trade deficit. The U.S. trade deficit at this point is at all-time high. And I have shown data that when American economy booms, the trade deficit expands. When the U.S. economy goes into a recession, the trade deficit is actually reduced. And now America is in a strong economic recovery, and therefore you would expect the trade deficit to expand. And last year, China recovered from the pandemic, from the lockdown, much sooner than the rest of the world. The first quarter, GDP was down 6.8%, but the country ended up the year with 2.3% growth. So China's production recovered and resumed after the second quarter, whereas the rest of the world went into a lockdown. Consequently, the Chinese exports surged, including to the United States. So the net result is that China's trade surplus actually increased. By the end of 2019, China's current account surplus came down to about less than 1%. But last year, it went up. And this year, I would expect it to go up even further. So the trade war has not had a meaningful or even noticeable negative effect on the Chinese exports. It has not reduced U.S. trade deficit at all. And as those of us who study economies, Lisa and others know that the cost of trade deficit is really not to what extent you impose tariffs and so forth. With regard to technology war, some companies are affected, such as Huawei, of course. They sold their mobile phone or smartphone business to others. But by and large, I think the Chinese private sector is not so much affected by the technology war. And the reason is that, again, China has a very big domestic market. Just look at private consumption. China's private consumption as a percentage of GDP is exceedingly low today, 39% of GDP, compared with 68% for the United States and 63% for the world average. Okay, China is only 39%. But 5 years ago, it was only 35%. So China's private consumption actually has increased. 10 years ago, let's say 2009, China's retail goods market was about $1.8 trillion compared with about $4 trillion for the United States. So less than half that of the United States. By the end of 2019, China's retail goods market rose to become more than $6 trillion. By the end of last year, China's retail goods market was $6 trillion compared with $5.5 trillion for the United States. So now larger than the United States, from less than half to larger than the United States. So the domestic market is very sizable, which is the advantage of big countries. For example, the airline industry, which is decimated in, for example, Europe, because anywhere you go, you cross international borders with lockdown and quarantine and so forth, flights and air travel has basically stopped. But in the U.S., the airline industry has largely recovered in the domestic market and in China as well, because the market is big enough. So the technology war has had some impact, but I don't think that it makes really a difference to China's economic growth. So I would expect China's economy to grow at least 8% this year. I don't know if Alicia agrees with that, and she looks at the macroeconomy more closely than I do, especially the statistics. But last year, China grew 2.3%. This year, about 8%. So year over year, I think the average in the past 2 years in Chinese economic growth rate will be 5%, regardless of trade war or technology war or whatever, unless China makes policy mistakes by itself. Otherwise, I think the momentum will continue.
Thank you, Shan. Alicia, do you have some initial thoughts and reflections or questions to Shan?
Well, first of all, thanks, Shan, for this illuminating discussion, you know, bringing us the reality of China's private sector, which was really the topic of our conversation. I mean, I'm very interested by the case you mentioned of a company that was only 200 million and you bought 50% and then it became very large. But, you know, the idea of having 800 consumers, yeah, 800 clients you mentioned, out of some copyrights that they obtained before, so far so good. But how can that be maintained? In other words, I understand that you were comparing to Europe fragmented markets, and indeed, that's the reality of Europe. But Europe is not only about fragmented markets. It's about privacy. It's about antitrust. It's about actually being very hard for a company to do what you just described, even within a country. So my question really is about how can some, not all, by the way, some, and why those and not others, some companies become so large in China? Could you answer that question? What's the trick? How can a company get 800 clients without anybody realizing, or if so, not doing anything about it, antitrust-wise?
That's a very good question. China has had an antitrust law, anti-monopoly law, since, I think, 2008, right? But the enforcement has not been very effective. So some companies has grown to be very large, and some companies has had practices which in Western countries, more advanced economies, will be considered to be antitrust behavior. For example, price fixing, for example, forcing certain customers to choose either me or somebody else, but not both. And some would have a monopoly type of status, such as Tencent Music. There's no question about it. And China has lately started to catch up with the rest of the world in this particular regard, this very regard of antitrust. In fact, in my view, Europe is the most advanced when it comes to regulation, whether it is antitrust, environmental protection, privacy, all these things. Europe is leading the rest of the world in adopting regulations. America, I think, is one step behind very often the European practices, and China is probably two steps behind the United States in this regard. But China is catching up, no question about it. And incidentally, TME, Tencent Music Entertainment, when we sold it a few months ago, the stock price was more than $30 per share. And now it's half of that level. Why? Because there's talk in China to break up the company. It has become very large. But the first step is, and the company has done this voluntarily, to license its copyrights to other players, you know, NetEase Music and maybe some other platforms. See, the Chinese market has been very different from, say, American market. In the United States, the big three, and that is Sony, Universal, and ENI, will have to license to anyone who pays the same rate, whether it's Amazon or Spotify or iTunes, you know, they will have to license to everyone. But in China, since the market was very new, and a few years ago, you could license from the big three on exclusive basis. So you get the license, nobody else will be able to get license. And that's your entry barrier. And that's how TME has built such a dominant business. Of course, they bought a lot of copyrights as well. So not only licensed, but also bought copyrights. And China's IP enforcement now is extremely effective and very rapid. So it would be difficult for others without copyrights to build a similar business. But since about 3 years ago, the rules have changed. So now the big three will have to license to everyone on equal basis. And in fact, it started with TME having to license its exclusive copyrights to others as well. You know, they license exclusively from, say, Universal, but then they have to turn around to sublicense to other players. So the regulation is stepping up, and we have seen that Alibaba has recently been fined for 4% of its revenue for antitrust behavior, and it is requested to fall into compliance within a certain period of time. And there has been talk about breaking up this monopoly and that monopoly. So it is coming. I think it will take some time, but experience tells me that China moves very fast once it's made up its mind to do so. For example, just 2 days ago, China decided to lift its birth control policy from 2 child per family to 3 child per family, just overnight, right? Which benefited some of our portfolio companies, which are the largest dairy farm business in China, producing milk. So if people, the market is fact, more infants, of course, milk consumption is expected to increase. So China can move very fast in this regard. And I think that you should look at Europe as a model where China will be, maybe over some period of time.
Thank you, Shan. This is extremely interesting because we dedicated our newsletter indeed on China's new antitrust. The policies are new, but as you said, the actual implementation of the policies are newer. And we did dedicate our newsletter because I think it's very important for China and for the world in terms of increasing competition in China, even within China. It doesn't have to necessarily be foreign competition, but of course, even within China. And I think this is important for the private sector because it means that there will be more opportunities for newcomers, that it won't be, you know, captured within the private sector, let alone, of course, frankly speaking, other oligopolies within the state-owned sector. You could think of energy or other sectors where this is still the case, or, you know, telecom industry to some extent. So my point is that as this policy is applied more generally, not only, you know, the big newcomers in the tech industry or the e-commerce industry, even better for China to become more competitive within its own borders. So that's one thing I wanted to mention. But I want to move very fast to slightly more intriguing topic, which is the role of the party. I can't but bring this to our audience. And as you know, one of the wake-up calls probably for some of our followers, or at least those following China more closely, is the opinion that was launched by the Central Committee of the CCP on September 15th to strengthen, quote-unquote, the united front work on the private economy. So in other words, to be sure that the private sector aligns its interests to those of the party, if I may say so. This might only be paper and not reality. And if so, I would be very happy to hear from you whether you think this is more of a warning than a reality in the daily operations of a private company in China.
Well, China has been under a one-party rule, right? Everybody knows about it. And when you think about one-party rule as compared with a democracy, you ask the question where the legitimacy of the leadership comes from. In a democracy, of course, leaders are elected. So if you're elected, you have the political legitimacy. But in a one-party system, how do you have legitimacy, especially if you are a leader who didn't assume leadership during wartime? You know, during wartime, if you lead a successful lead the victory against a foreign power like the anti-Japanese war, like the World War II, you would acquire legitimacy like Mao did. But in peacetime, then you would question, where do you get your legitimacy if you're not elected? And I think, at least in the Chinese context, the only source of legitimacy, in my view, is delivery of economic performance. Correct? If you cannot improve the living standard of the people, like in the years of Mao, then eventually you lose legitimacy. If Mao came into power with very strong legitimacy. You know, in 1950, if there had been an election, he would have been elected hands down because he won the wars. But over the years, his legitimacy was lost because of mismanagement of the economy, all the disasters that he brought. And eventually, Deng came to power and initiated economic reforms, which really changed China. In the past 30 years, Chinese GDP grew 36 times. 36 times. You know, 20 years ago, China was 1/9 that of the United States in dollar terms. And today it's 3/4 of the United States in dollar terms. And in purchasing power parity terms, it is larger than the United States at $24 trillion compared with $21 trillion for the United States. So the party, of course, would like to maintain its rule, but its predominant objective is to grow the economy, as we have seen in the past 40 years. And we have invested in many private companies in China. We have privatized state-owned companies as well. And we know that in some companies, especially large ones, there are party organizations. But in the companies which we control, we have seen no interference from party organizations at all. For example, we have a number of so many foreign companies operating in China, whether it's Apple, it's Tesla, which 100% owns, is the largest operation in China, the largest operation in the world, that is in China. General Motors sells more cars made in China and in China than the entire North America combined. That includes Mexico, the United States, and Canada. Now, all these operations, of course, operate very independently from any kind of interference the party. And to me, to be honest with you, in the companies which we control, the party organization is mostly a welfare provider. It's like a club for the staff. They organize certain events like spring outing and so forth. So I think that the reality in China is that, of course, there's no free press. And of course, the party maintains a very tight control. But when it comes to the private sector, I think the party's policy is to encourage the private sector, which, of course, in the past 40 years, is really what has driven China's economic growth. You know, you wouldn't expect the central planned economy, which brought economic disasters to China 40 years ago, to produce this kind of growth. And China has grown because it has embraced a market economy and private sector. So I would expect this to continue. Nobody, I would think, in his right mind, would want to kill the golden goose or the goose which lays the golden egg.
Thank you, Shen. I can't agree more. So I have nothing to add on this. Maybe Giuseppe has.
That's very enlightening, and it goes very in-depth on what is the situation. From my side, because we are going towards the end of this episode, I would like a last question, which is a little bit of a follow-up to all this conversation that we had so far, and which is a more future-oriented kind of question. You mentioned in your final words about what to expect for the private sector. I mean, at least what you expect for the private sector of China is definitely, from what I understand and what you're seeing, is to continue to grow in the future. And if we would have to wrap up and really look like into a crystal ball, and you would imagine the private sector in China in 20 years. I don't know if that is too far-fetched as a question, but what would you imagine this to be look like?
Well, it will continue to grow, no question about it, along with the growth of the entire Chinese economy. But I wouldn't expect the state-owned sector to disappear. I think the state sector will still play a very significant role. I used to think many years ago that there's nothing that a private company cannot do better than a state-owned company. In recent years, I have changed my mind because I have seen to what extent China has invested and built its infrastructure. It's astounding. In the past 15 years, China has built a high-speed rail system larger, twice as large, more than twice as large as the rest of the world combined. Okay, and the United States doesn't even have one single kilometer of high-speed rail. And what is the concept of high-speed rail? You know, living in Europe, you know what it is. And in China, it's the average speed of more than 300 kilometers or about 200 miles. And in America, of course, there's Acela from, let's say, New York to Boston, and the average speed is only 65 miles. You know, from Beijing to Shanghai, the distance is about 800 miles, which is about the same as the distance from Boston to Chicago. For that distance, by China's high-speed rail system, it takes now 3 hours and 58 minutes. For Amtrak, from Boston to Chicago, it takes 21 hours and 58 minutes, and 50% more expensive. And that is a huge difference. So China has built a 40,000 kilometer high-speed rail system in just 15 years. Now, China invests 10 times as much in infrastructure in terms of percentage of GDP as the United States, 10 times. In absolute terms, China invests 7 times more as the United States in infrastructure. And that has made a big difference. So now China has better roads, better ports, better airports, better high-speed rail system. You know, you walk around China, you travel around China, and travel around the United States, you see the difference. And China also last year claimed to have eradicated poverty by the World Bank standard entirely, right? And if you think about it, the private sector can't do that. The high-speed rail system doesn't make money. It has a lot of externalities which cannot be internalized within a company. So the state-owned sector actually plays a role in building an infrastructure. You know, of the 100 tallest bridges in the world, 2/3 are in China. And that, I think, can only be done by the state-owned sector. So I think there's a role for the state-owned sector. But the larger economy, especially in the competitive industries, it has to be the private sector. I don't see state-owned companies to be able to compete with private companies. So looking forward in 20 years, I would say there will be a small state-owned sector, maybe 15% of GDP, but the private sector will be 85% of GDP. That's what I would like to see at least. And I think that state-owned sector should get out completely from competitive industries and focus only on, you know, things like infrastructure that the private sector doesn't do.
Thank you so much, Shan. I don't know if Alicia would like to have just a very final remark or reflection to what we just heard.
Well, first of all, it's really, of course, wonderful to have a country like China achieving what China has achieved, because it means that others can do it in the developing world. And this is illuminating for others, no doubt about it. I think I would like to see in the next 20 years that very same bridge and high-speed railway to be open to competition to foreign companies or even private companies. I think state-owned companies can still do it if they win the auction and at the very same price. And that's the reason why I mentioned this, is that we published a report on competitive neutrality, on the idea that state-owned companies have all the right to exist, not only in China, but we have many in Europe, Shan, so many. Yes. And maybe not all are competitively neutral, to be very frank. But the whole idea, and this is a concept for Europe, developed in Australia, OECD imported for any OECD countries, that yes, it's great to have state-owned companies, but they need to kind of abide to the same rules and regulations and compete within their own terms. And of course, the externalities are there. There is a way to encapsulate them into subsidies that anybody could have access to. So in a way, that idea that we have in Europe, that we like capitalism, market economies with a social sense behind, i.e. that we protect our people, that we eradicate poverty, that we allow state-owned companies to operate, but within those rules and regulations, antitrust being one, but also, as I mentioned, transparent subsidies, etc., and competing with the rest. That would be my add-on to the 20-year vision that Shan just went through. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So my own preference is that the state-owned sector should get out of competitive industries at all, completely. I think that it's good for competitive neutrality, but I just don't think that state-owned sector or companies belong to competitive industries. I think that in competitive industries, there's nothing that the private sector cannot do better than the state-owned sector. But I also understand they exist, and if they do exist, then I think competitive neutrality is a rule that they should follow.
And thank you so much, Shan and Alicia. And on this note, of course, we could go on for quite a while because the discussion is so interesting, but we have to close this episode. And I would like once again to thank also our listeners for tuning in to The Sound of Economics. And I would like to remind everyone that this episode was part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes as well a monthly newsletter, Zhonghua Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. And as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. So thank you for joining The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.